Hey guys, Mike back with you. One of the questions we're always asked is, hey, when is a review course going to come to my area? The best resource for you is to check flightbridgeed.com. Courses are being updated almost daily. If there's not one coming next to you, guess what? We've got the fully accredited online university where you can take courses from FlightBridgeEd, FoamFrat, and the list goes on. So check out FlightBridgeEd.com today for more information.
The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey guys, welcome to the FlightBridge Ed Podcast. Mike Verkest doing a quick intro for you. This was a live that Bruce Hoffman, Eric Bauer, and I did a couple weeks ago on the topic of advanced hemodynamics. Lots of questions out there going around about this topic, so we thought it was valuable enough to go ahead and make it a podcast. So we hope you enjoy it. Take care, and we appreciate you listening to the FlightBridge Ed Podcast.
So why don't you, give a little background, just, 30 seconds of your cath lab experience.
Yeah, sure thing. So both a nurse and a paramedic here, worked clinically for, still do, close to 15 years here. And a good chunk of that was spent in the cardiothoracic ICU as well as the cath and EP lab. And I loved that time. Those were some of the best days. And we got to fulfill basically three roles there, acting as scrubbing in next to the physician, doing some recording, and then also circulating that room. And you learn a tremendous amount. It's kind of one of the benefits of having that kind of the perfect trifecta or those three roles, because you get to see each piece of it so closely and intimately. And that's really what helped me kind of push the edge for me in terms of advanced hemodynamics as well as balloon pumps and that kind of stuff. So great opportunity. I actually just talked to a good friend of mine out in the Missouri area. And he let me know, it's Clint Klepping. He told me that he just got a job in the cath lab as a paramedic, and they were psyched to hire him as a paramedic into that lab. And I said, buddy, you are going to learn a tremendous amount. And he's psyched. He's got a great learning edge before him. So I was pretty stoked about that. Paramedics, I think, play a key role in the cath lab. And I think they're underutilized, as I've written about a few times, in the kind of the acute care and critical care.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, and even kind of going back to your article, that was it December in EMS World about sort of the intra-hospital transport, right? And sort of how big of a deal that's starting to become with different places. So
totally. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Bobby, I'm going to throw it right back at you, dude. Tell me a little bit about you and your experience with advanced hemodynamics. Cause I think one of the things that Mike kind of alluded to in the beginning was that you kind of each come with your specific skill set and background. And I think that makes like kind of the perfect combo.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at the overall, number of patients that you transport, I flew for almost 17 years. I bet I had 10 patients in 17 years that had a Swan Ganz catheter. So that's the thing. And I bet you I haven't had any in the last few or prior to stopping in the transport side or medically. I have taught it for about 8 years, and I flew with some nurses that's all they did, right? So I think that the thing about teaching as many review courses I've taught, I think we're up to 178, is I do think that you definitely take nuggets away from different providers. I think that I learned something every single course. Mm-hmm. And then, if there's an area that I don't feel like maybe there's a question that's raised or something that I don't know, I definitely look that up. I definitely find somebody that's an expert in that area, and I try to seek that out. And I think the thing that I've realized about medicine is that the things are not always done the same way. Just because you might see one hospital do something doesn't mean that that's how the whole country does things. And for so sure. I've really been able to, after, last year, I mean, as we taught between our online and our live classes 4,500 students. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people. That's in 1 year. And so I think when you look at the sample size that I've been able to be exposed to, I really tell every class that I've learned as much from them as I have hopefully taught them. So just with teaching advanced hemodynamics for the last, you know, 8 years and flying for 16, 17 years, that's my experience. I probably have more educational experience than I do application experience, right? You know, real life patients, that's where you come in and you have the other side. But I feel like I've really tried to surround myself with people that have that experience to make sure that I, you know, those questions that you get that are tough questions, or those questions you get that are those obscure questions that you don't ever hear about. Mm-hmm. You know, what does the masses say? What are the people that I'm surrounded with that are the experts in, they've seen hundreds of patients. What do they say? Right.
Absolutely.
And so I definitely feel like this is going to be a great episode of RB Live segment, and where we can hit on some tough questions that I feel very, very strongly that we are going to be able to portray the right approach that is definitely the standard practice.
So Bruce, why don't you take us away here and walk us through this first case?
Absolutely. So I think when we start out talking about advanced hemodynamics, I think one of the things that Eric and I and Mike and Ashley, those of us that teach, really try to harp on is that it's helpful to bring a clinical application scenario kind of into the starting point of understanding advanced hemodynamics. So we'll start out with this case study. We'll go through it and we'll talk a little bit about it. Then we'll jump into some clinical pearls, some takeaways, and then we'll revisit that case study at the end and see if we can kind of close the loop on some of this. So why do we care so much about advanced hemodynamics? So if you read this case study, this is a 26-year-old male whose status post-fall into a quarry. He's got a head injury, intubated, sedated, paralyzed after some combativeness. Looks like he has a blood pressure of 70s over 40, heart rate of 57, respiratory rate of 13, saturations of 94%. He's being mechanically ventilated, SIMV at 16, with a tidal volume of 700, an FiO2 of 1 or 100%, and a PEEP of 15. And then we have here that he has arterial and pulmonary artery catheters that are placed before you get there. And those readings, and these are some of the values that we can get from advanced hemodynamic monitoring. And specifically, we get this information from what we call pulmonary artery catheter, or though a catheter sitting inside the right side of the heart, right atrium, right ventricle into the pulmonary artery. And we're going to be monitoring that system. So we have a CVP or central venous pressure of 0. We have a PA pressure of 14 systolic over 3 diastolic. We have a wedge pressure of 2. A cardiac output, remember Q is the appropriate medical abbreviation for cardiac output, of 7.9. And we have an SVR of 687. So that's the case. So young, healthy male falls off a cliff into a quarry. We see he's hypotensive, he's bradycardic, which send up some red flags and say that's a little bit, you know, that's a little bit weird. And then being mechanically ventilated, and then we have some hemodynamic values there. So why do we care so much about this? We care so much about this because we are able to use some of these hemodynamic parameters to tell us or help us differentiate what type of shock this patient may be suffering from. So not only do we have hemodynamics from the left side of the heart in the arterial system, systole over diastole, now we can use some numbers on the right side of the heart to be able to apply those and say, I think this patient may have this type of shock. And it's going to help us try to kind of better care for our patient by identifying the style of hypoperfusion that they may be suffering from. Eric, you want to jump in and comment on that a little bit?
Yeah. Can we put the big picture back,
yep,
scenario,
yep,
back? So yep, I think there's some things. I think for the nursing side, if you are an ER nurse, this may be overwhelming to you. If you're an ICU nurse that worked in, you know, a cardiac ICU or you know, any ICU where they were doing routine swans, I think this is probably very routine. So what I always say for the paramedic side is that try to make it simple for yourselves. And I always try to ask myself, you know, what is the scenario? And there's a couple things that I want to point out before we ever get into the hemodynamic side. Is you have a patient with a blood pressure that is severely hypotensive. So a systolic less than 80, we know is ominous. But you have a heart rate of 57
mm-hmm.
on a 26-year-old male patient, right? This yeah. isn't somebody that's 70 that has Zon beta blockade
or whatever.
Right, yeah. right. So those two things together, and you know, as far as test-taking skills, you know, we obviously have the module dominating the testing environment where we go into how to break down a question. But there are certain key things that any test writer is trying to convey to you. And it really is important for you to be able to pick up on those things. And to me, when I read a blood pressure that is that low and a heart rate that's low, there's two things that I'm thinking of. Number one, that is irreversible shock, number one. But that doesn't match. That doesn't match the SpO2. That doesn't match the age of the patient. That doesn't match really anything that I'm seeing. Yeah. And the second thing is it's leading me down to a certain type of shock state. Why would somebody have a low blood pressure and a low heart rate? There's really, to me, there's one type of patient.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say that, but I think that is something you have to think about. Why would somebody not be able to compensate, especially at 26?
Absolutely.
What would block their compensation? And I'm going to leave it at that and we'll break this down. But those are two things that stick out that we have to just make it simple. Those are things that you should be able to clue in on very, very quickly. Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think you've hit it right on the head. You can tell a lot by reading this question, really about what's going on with this patient here. But the point is, if you're in like a testing environment, for example, you may not get some of those little tidbits, right? You're going to get some hemodynamic values only, right? And say, based on what do you see, what do you think is going on with this patient here? So I think you hit the nail on the head. So let's jump into that discussion real quick and bring up this slide that I had prematurely put up before. But thanks for asking what I thought, Eric. I appreciate that. He's always doing that to me.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
He's always trying to challenge a brother. That's okay.
So I really like what both you and Eric had to say, because I think it brings out kind of the three variants of kind of what we're talking about, right? I think nurses, you know, especially those that have worked in the intensive care unit, this is something that they're very familiar with, whereas maybe on the paramedic side, not something that you're as familiar with. And I think Mike and Eric, you both kind of touched on it indirectly, and that is, I think pulmonary artery catheters are one of those kind of low volume or low frequency kind of patients that we see. And so all of a sudden you're kind of throwing these hemodynamic numbers and you're trying to kind of make some kind of sense of it. And I think that's where Eric's approach is really good. You kind of got to take a look at the whole scenario and then say, can these numbers help me kind of whittle my way down to coming to what type of shock this may be, right? So I think that's kind of a nice way to bring that full circle.
I like it.
All right, so we got a couple clinical discussion points up there on the screen. We're going to take number one and kind of work our way all the way down. So the first question / comment that's up here for discussion is this. A pulmonary artery catheter becomes wedged inadvertently. So you're on a transport, you're either in a helicopter or you know, an ambulance, and you're on your way, and the pulmonary artery catheter waveform now displays a pulmonary artery capillary wedge pressure. It becomes wedged. These pulmonary artery catheters have a balloon on the distal portion of them that you can inflate with air. That balloon allows that swan to literally sail through the right-sided circulatory system. It's almost like a sail. That's how Dr. Swan or Dr. Gans, one of them, really came up with the idea of getting that catheter to float through the right side vessels. The balloon then kind of wedges through the pulmonary artery and down into a very small pulmonary arteriole. And the balloon literally causes a wedge. It obstructs flow from the right side to the left side. That's what that balloon is doing. And that's what we mean when we say the catheter inadvertently becomes wedged. That balloon, which has the catheter attached to it, has become wedged in a tiny pulmonary artery capillary. And literally the transducer of this catheter is sitting just distal to that balloon. So what we typically use that measurement for when it's in the wedge position is looking at the preload on the left side of the heart. However, if you are during transport and you have a pulmonary artery catheter that's displaying a nice pulmonary artery waveform, and then all of a sudden you see it go into the wedge position, that's bad news. We need to do something about that. Eric and I and Mike will touch on this in a little bit, but one of the pearls is that we don't wedge catheters during transport, right? So that's probably clinical pearl number one. But let's go back and revisit this first point, which says, let's say that pulmonary artery catheter sails through and it becomes wedged inadvertently. What do we do about that? What do we do about that? So the first thing that we're going to, well, Eric, let me throw it out there. Eric and Mike, what are we going to do about that? So that's kind of our case, right? We're kind of taking this small case. We have this 26-year-old guy. We have this Swan-Ganz catheter in. We're in the pulmonary artery position. And all of a sudden during transport, you see that catheter become wedged.
Well, let me ask you this. What can you tell me? Because like I said, if you're just joining, this is not my specialty at all.
Yeah.
I've never dealt with these things. I don't even teach them as part of the FlyBridgeEd team. That's like, because we don't do that, right? I'll talk about the stuff I know about. Yeah. But can you give kind of the, maybe the person that doesn't know a lot, how would that physically happen? Would there be a leak in that balloon that would allow it to float? Like what are some of the things that would cause that to occur?
So I think one, the patient could kind of self-adjust, right? They may have rolled, they may have turned. That can cause the catheter to change position. Sometimes if we as providers are not very careful with that equipment, sometimes we may actually inadvertently adjust it and that may push it forward. Sometimes patients who are taking super big deep breaths, right? That can also cause the catheter to migrate. Eric, what are your thoughts?
No, I think, you know, you have to understand the size of a pulmonary artery, you know, I mean, just the overall diameter of a pulmonary artery is right around 2.5 centimeters. And so when you start looking at the branches off of the pulmonary artery, that is even smaller, right? And we're wedging into those locations. So when that initial catheter is placed in the interventional lab, that is usually wedged twice, right? Balloon is up. As Bruce said and articulated perfectly, the whole concept of a PA catheter is that it is a catheter that is was made to flow based on that sail mentality. And Dr. Swan and Dr. Gans were sitting actually in California, and they were looking at a sailboat along the ocean, and that's where they came up with the idea. And so it is a flow-directed catheter. And so it is, the balloon is up, the catheter is floated into that wedge position on two different times.
Occasions,
yeah. Occasions, right. Basically, balloon is up, it's floated in, it's wedged, wedge pressure is identified, it is ballooned down, it's pulled back, it's then re-wedged. So the point is that it could easily become inadvertently wedged without the balloon being up. If it's sitting against the wall of this tiny little, you know, arterial mm-hmm. it easily can become occluded and wedge off. And so that is the key thing, and this is something that is actually very common. It happens in the ICU all the time. Mm-hmm. It is truly something that is very routine. And the most common thing is a three-step prong approach. Is number one, you log roll your patient. If the patient is able to cough, then have them cough,
yeah,
and then log roll your patient. And usually one of those two things will usually 99.9% of the time fix the problem. It is very, very rarely that there's anything else needed in those situations.
Yep. Yeah, 100% agree. And I think so, you know, to kind of dovetail on that, right?
Yeah.
So let's say those two things don't work. And this is probably more of the clinical applicability piece of it, right? 99.9% of the time, I agree. If you log roll that patient side to side, or if you have that patient take a deep breath in and probably going to have that catheter migrate a little bit, and it'll come off of that wall or come out of that wedge position. But so Eric, let's talk about the situation where you, that doesn't work, right? Log roll your patient or cough and that doesn't work. And I think this is probably one thing that we kind of want to emphasize. And that is, you know, we don't want people manipulating these pulmonary artery catheters. Like, that is the last stage at all costs, right? This is an invasive line. We don't want people touching it. However, with a pulmonary artery catheter, and I think Eric and you know, we get a kick out of this every time we talk about it, there's a swandom, right? A condom for a swan over, come on, buddy, you got to give me a little credit for that, right? Tiny little bit, right?
Did you make that up?
No, that's what I learned that from an interventional cardiologist like 10 years ago.
Okay.
So it's a little, it's a swandom that goes, so it's a condom that goes over literally the external pieces of the swan. So that if they want to manipulate the catheter, you can do it with being, you know, sterile. But in the transport setting, like, whoosh, no way, right? So let's say the catheter does inadvertently wedge. The wrong thing to do, right? Log rolling, coughing. The wrong thing to do is to push that catheter in further, right? Because you are literally causing an embolus in that pulmonary circuit. So no way, right? We don't want that. And we don't even want people pulling that catheter back because it is so sensitive. So I think the clinical pearl is to A, watch your waveforms, monitor, handle the equipment carefully, log roll that patient, have that patient take a deep breath and cough, and almost guaranteed some kind of, you know, combination of those things. Yeah. We'll get that catheter.
Yeah. I mean, if that ever happened to me, I mean, I would pull it back? No, I would not. I would probably try to roll it in my fingers and see, you know, if just rolling it in my fingers and watching the markings, remember from the distal tip, you know, every 10 centimeters, you're going to have a mark. So you're definitely going to know where that is secured and where that location is as it comes out of the, you know, the cortis at the location of insertion, usually the IJ. And it's usually, they usually try to place them on the right side. So, you know, where is that at? Making sure that I'm watching that very closely, making sure that I don't advance that forward or pull it back. And I'm just rolling that in my fingers, just again, you got to think it's a line. And so that vessel is very small, very easy to occlude off.
Sure thing. I think, and there is like another clinical pearl or clinical nugget. When you jump to transport a patient with a pulmonary artery catheter, Swan-Ganz catheter, the one thing that you want to measure is where are you? What length is that catheter coming out of the end of that sheath, right? So you have a sheath that's inserted in, and the Swan-Ganz catheter goes through that sheath, kind of like a one-way valve down, you float the catheter in. You want to, wherever that Swan-Ganz exits that sheath, you need to measure that, and you need to record that in your documentation, but also for your clinical care so that you know if that catheter migrates or not, right? So that's kind of another clinical piece of that, is making sure that you measure and record. So typically, if you're looking at this one, dark black lines are 50 centimeters, thin black lines are 10. And that's a way to know that, basically. So I think that's like, yeah, those are... That just that discussion probably takes you into the care that we're going to render probably about 90% of the time, right? So anyway, let's jump into what's pearl number two here. PA catheter. The pulmonary artery catheter migrates from the pulmonary artery position to the RV position.
Yeah. So, Mike, why don't you explain why we're doing this Be Live?
Yeah, let's back it up for a minute. Yeah.
All right, hold on a sec. I was right in the middle of doing something else and you got me screwed up. All right, what do you want to know?
Well, why this question number two is really the reason why we're doing this Be Live. Why is that?
Well, there seems to be a lot of confusion about this.
Yeah, so let's just be honest, guys. I mean, we feel like as a company we are we have to lead the way. We have received a few different notifications from a few different students that took another course that were being taught something that we know is absolutely incorrect, and that really is where this Be Live came about. So that is where question number two is: what do we do in this situation?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially this is a pulmonary artery catheter, Swan-Ganz catheter, that's in the pulmonary artery position. So it's monitoring. You're seeing a dicrotic notch to the right side of that waveform. Pulmonary artery pressures, remember, 15 to 25, right? 7 to 10, 12 on the diastolic side. So you're monitoring your pulmonary artery pressure, life is good, and then all of a sudden you see that pulmonary artery pressure change to an RV pressure, a right ventricular pressure, right? So we know, critical thinking says, that catheter likely got pulled back or migrated back out of the pulmonary artery through the pulmonic valve and is now kind of whipping around inside the right ventricle. So Eric, let's first kind of talk about some of the major complications of this, right? So if you have a catheter that is migrated from the pulmonary artery down in through the pulmonic valve back into the right ventricle, the right ventricle is dynamic, right? So it's a cavern, it's squeezing every, 60 to 80 times a minute. And there's that catheter is stimulating the myocardial wall, essentially giving you ectopy, right? So on top of seeing an RV pressure, you'll probably have little salvos or runs of ventricular tachycardia, and rightly so. That catheter is just kind of knocking around and exciting all these different myocytes around that right ventricular myocardium. And so I think one of the teaching points here is that people get very excited and they're like, dang, we got to treat those, that ventricular tachycardia. And the answer is not amiodarone or lidocaine or anything else. We really know we have to take that stimulus away. But that's kind of jumping ahead a little bit. Let's kind of go back. So pulmonary artery catheter in the PA position, and it's migrated back into the RV. So Eric, what is one of the things that we don't want to do?
So let's go into, this. Here's the thing, guys, is this is the difference between teaching and understanding what happens in real life. And I think there's definitely a fine line of what you maybe perceive and really what happens. I think the thing that these students came to us and emailed us and asked us was, basically they're being taught that you would advance it forward into the PA, pulmonary artery into the wedge position or that location where it could be eventually wedged if need be. And that is 150,000% not the right way to do this. Mm-hmm. And that is just not realistic. And here's the thing. When you think about the evolution of this catheter, it was, invented in 1970, and Bruce talked about this and illustrated that it was based on the whole balloon being the sail, and it's a flow-driven catheter. And if you have ever actually put one of these catheters in or assisted in putting one of these catheters in, you would completely understand that floating the catheter back into the PA location is absolutely the incorrect way to handle this. There's no way around it. Now there may be, and I've had a few nurses out there in small facilities tell me that they had been checked off by a physician and that they were allowed to do this. But that is very well. I'm going to say two people out of 10,000 that we've taught, right? So I don't even count that. This is a flow-driven catheter. And we have to understand that these catheters are placed in patients that have hemodynamic instability. They have right and left ventricular failure.
Failure, yeah.
And if you have a patient in poor flow, if you've ever put one of these in, I've never put one of these in, but I've watched a few of these be placed. Both of the ones that I can remember that I watched, that I vividly remember, even the cardiologist had a very difficult time. It took forever to get this in place. One of them even actually knotted up. And here's the thing. This is a flow-driven catheter, as I said. And if you have a poor flow state where you have a patient that has an EF of, you know, 10, 15, 20%, the catheter is not going to flow into place. It's got to turn a corner. And it's got to turn the corner through the right ventricle into the pulmonary artery. And we are not, as paramedics and nurses, going to be able to float that back in place. That is absolutely unrealistic. And so that is very frustrating to me that we are teaching, or there are people out there teaching this, where we could cause harm to our patients, right? And that is, and I might be pretty being pretty bold about this, but I think at FlatBridgeHead, we really try to teach based on what is the standard practice. What would a physician do? What would a medical director do in those situations? And if we don't know those answers, we definitely go to those experts and ask those questions. You know, we have to understand that that as that catheter passes through the tricuspid valve, you know, the chordae tendinae in the right ventricular wall, that is a very narrow space. That is, yeah, there's that is very crowded in there. And just passing through that location is very, very difficult. And then getting it through the RV in a low flow state and getting it to turn that corner is very, very difficult. And so if you think about in a transport setting, you've never done this, that you're going to advance this back into the PA, it's not going to happen. And so you have to think about risk mitigation. What is the safest thing that's going to happen? What is, I mean, I can tell you, consulting and being part of multiple companies, I've never seen a guideline or a protocol that would ever have you do that.
Yeah, no way.
And so the right thing to do would be to always pull it back. It's always to pull it back into the CVP location and leave it there.
So that kind of brings us right into number three, right? Yeah. So do we wedge during transport?
No.
I mean, no. That seems pretty cut and dry to me, right?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. I mean, you think about this. So, you know, Eric, I'll kind of take it from the in-house side of the fence, and you can talk about it a little bit in the you know, kind of out of hospital setting. But in the lab, we're typically under live fluoro, you know, fluoroscopy, so we can see, you know, not necessarily, you know, how we can see the location, right, of the catheter, kind of what cavity it's in, and we pair that with the waveform that we see. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's a little bit more of a safe environment, right, where we can, you know, certainly float that catheter forward. But in the transport setting where it is blind, pushing that catheter forward, not only can you damage the myocardial wall, the right ventricular myocardial wall, to get that catheter to curl up and float up and through and into the pulmonary artery through the pulmonic valve in a low flow state, you're asking for trouble. You're asking for trouble. And remember, as that catheter coils right inside the right ventricle, it's probably not going to be moving as much as it was before. You have risk of clots forming on that catheter. Now you go to move that catheter all of a sudden and push it forward. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So there's a lot of issues with that. Yeah, we definitely don't want to push it forward in the event that it gets pulled back into the RV.
I mean, here it is, guys, is that when you look at the instruction side, and I will say that early in my career, you know, just based on the test questions that you would see on the FPC, the CFRN, the questions were almost written. And it's funny looking back at it now, there's a way to write a question in a way that is very direct. And there's a way that's called a teaching question. And I've learned the hard way through Alan Wolf critiquing the way, you know, you write questions, is that you, mm-hmm. a educator is always going to want to write a teaching question. And that basically gives you a lot of information. It gives you information about, I mean, you're trying to teach through the question, right? And that's not right. The way you should write a question. But a lot of questions are written that way because I don't mm-hmm. think we realize we're writing them in that way. And the way the questions are written oftentimes in the FPC and CFRN exam lead you to believe that you're going to wedge the catheter every time. They lead you to believe, right? Because that's what the question is asking you. you know, when you come upon a very standard question, you come upon a patient in a ICU setting, in a transport setting, the first thing you do is identify the syringe, the test questions about how much do you inflate the balloon, and mm-hmm. you're going to immediately wedge the catheter. That is not going to happen. Absolutely not going to happen. But the question leads the provider, especially the paramedic that has never had experience in that, to believe that that's what he or she is going to do. And that is not the case. And I think that's what led us to do this episode, is that there is a big, big difference in what is perceived on an exam and what is real life. And it's taken me years to realize that is that is not what's going to happen. Let's also understand that when you think about, as Bruce alluded to, do you wedge a catheter? And Mike brought that question up. There may be circumstances in the cath lab that on initial insertion that they wedge the catheter one time. There may be certain circumstances in the ICU that as the patient enters that ICU, they may have a protocol. They may have a protocol to wedge the catheter one time. What they're going to do, though, is they're going to compare that wedge pressure to whatever the pulmonary artery diastolic pressure is. We know that standardly, a PA diastolic is 8 to 15, a wedge is 8 to 12. They're usually 2 to 4 points apart, with a PA diastolic higher by 2 to 4. Mm. And so they're going to get that variance, and they're going to, at that point, from continuous, they are not going to wedge the catheter. They're going to completely look at the PA diastolic and identify indirectly what the left ventricular end diastolic pressure is. And I don't think that we understand as paramedics, and Bruce, I want you to jump in on this, is that the pulmonary vasculature is very thin. These are very tiny vessels. It is actually a much more common than we realize to have a rupture of that vessel.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you inflate that vessel or inflate that balloon at the wrong time, even with a cardiologist doing this, you can rupture that pulmonary artery or a vessel off the pulmonary artery. And, a lot of times that leads to death.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right? Go ahead.
No, it, a lot of times it leads to death. So even physicians will tell you that they don't get any real information from a wedge pressure in comparison to a pulmonary artery diastolic pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's like a great example of saying, and I think a lot of these catheters, honestly, current practice, and we saw this, I wrote a couple articles on the flow directed pulmonary artery catheter, and a physician, an intensivist, kind of said, we don't even use those anymore. Right. So I think the times that we do see these, maybe when you're pulling a patient directly out of a cath lab that then is headed, to a different place for surgery or whatever, and the pulmonary artery catheter is there. But I would totally agree with Eric, and that is, you have a pulmonary, if you can find the difference on initial insertion between the pulmonary artery capillary wedge pressure and the pulmonary artery diastolic pressure, as soon as you know what that difference is and the patient stays somewhat hemodynamically, what I would call eudynamic, right? Then we know what that difference is, and we can use the PA diastolic pressure to kind of gauge where we're at. So 100%, Eric, 100%.
I mean, if I walked into a transfer setting and somebody had a Swan, and let's say that I walked in and I looked at the monitor and I said, and I saw a PA pressure of 35 over 28,
mm-hmm.
right? Normal PA systolic is 15 to 25, diastolic is 8 to 15.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know they're both high. I know that the wedge pressure is usually 2 to 4 points different. I mean, right? The pulmonic valve is going to maintain a diastolic pressure in that pulmonary artery. That's the whole point of that pulmonic valve.
Yeah.
So it's going to be very, very close. All I'm going to ask the nurses, what have the standard diastolic pressures been on the pulmonary artery? And if I'm high and I'm above what my normal numbers are, do I really care what the wedge pressure is? I really don't. It doesn't give me any more information. If the pulmonary artery diastolic pressures are higher than they should be, there's only one reason why that can happen, guys. Mm-hmm. There's only one reason. It's a left systolic or diastolic dysfunction, most often a diastolic dysfunction.
Sure.
There's no other reason why. So I guess that's where understanding the hemodynamic side, the shock state side, it doesn't give you any relevant information. And I think that's where taking these tests really leads you to believe that, oh, well, every time I'm going to have a Swan, which is going to be very rare, let's just be honest about it, you're going to have to wedge a catheter, which you've never done. And that is absolutely not the case.
Yeah, not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some good comments going on here. So Jeff Dixon says that probably 80 to 90% of the paramedics have zero experience with these things unless they're working in critical care. And even then, how much actual real life experience do they have with them? And then yeah. Eric Swearingen came back with the comment of basically it's the same with transport nurses. Unless they have a life previous to their transport experience, they've probably not dealt with these things very much either.
Totally. Especially if you have nurses that have only worked in the ED, you're not going to have any of this. So, Eric, I think you touched on a point that I think is important, and that, you know, lots of points that were important, but here's something. Why do we care so much? And why do we harp on this whole wedge pressure thing? Right. A lot of people are led to believe, and I think Eric, this is something that, you know, you and Mike, you've jumped in here as well. The CVP, central venous pressure, people have been very used to knowing that as the perfect way to identify volume status in a patient, right? Central venous pressure equals volume status in a patient. And, you know, I think just from my experience and where I've worked, I don't know that I totally agree with that, right? Yeah. I'm gonna kind of push the envelope here and say, I think the wedge pressure is going to be most indicative of volume status, because that really speaks to left ventricular clearing or refilling, right? So what I want to know is really what's in the left ventricle at the end of diastole. That's going to give me an adequate representation of the volume in the vasculature, right? And so if you think about it, left ventricle backs up into the left atrium into the pulmonary veins, capillary, pulmonary arterioles, pulmonary artery, capillary wedge pressure, right? So it's kind of all this one continuous circuit. And so, you know, I don't mean to kind of harp on it, but I would really like to say that the pulmonary, the wedge pressure is really the truest indicator of volume status. And that's going to be either hypervolemia, hypovolemia, probably more sensitive to cases where you are hypervolemic than hypovolemic. You know, certainly we have the advent of ultrasound where you can look at the vena cava and see if they're engorged or not. That's a great way to identify fluid. But just to kind of take the advanced hemodynamics piece and really push it to the edge, I think wedge pressure is really the best indicator of what's going on inside that left ventricle at the end of diastole.
So let's replace that with diastolic PA.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And
yeah, absolutely.
That's what I want you to really think about. Is get rid of the whole thought. And when we teach advanced hemodynamics, I use that interchangeably. All right, we talk about wedge. I want you to get rid of that from your mindset and think of diastolic PA, because it's going to tell you the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as long as you know the difference there. But yeah, essentially, right. Yeah. Yep, exactly right.
So let's go to number four.
All right. So I'm not sure if the balloon is inflated or deflated. So we know that, you know, there's really two ports that we don't like to touch on pulmonary artery catheters. The distal port, right? The distal port to the pulmonary artery catheter, which if it's in the pulmonary artery position, empties out in the pulmonary artery. And then the other port that we don't want to touch is the balloon port. Typically call that red and yellow. And Eric, right? Hit it off with our perfect rhyme here, buddy. What do we got?
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that when Dr. Swan and Dr. Gans were trying to identify the different ports and the different port colors and try to identify how can we relay to the clinical providers handling these ports that these two ports, they need to have caution. And so they actually, Dr. Gans actually sat down and they were frustrated. They couldn't figure it out. They sat down and he happened to stumble across a book, and the book was a book of snakes. And he come across the whole riddle of red touch, yellow kill a fellow of the coral snake, red touch, black venom lack. And so we know that coral snakes are in the, you know, Texas in the Southwest area. It's the most venomous snake in North America. And the whole riddle of red touch, yellow kill a fellow, when that red and yellow stripe is together, that's a coral snake. If there's a black stripe in between, that is a king snake. And so that's really where they came up with the two colors to give us caution. You know, I think it's often that when we ask this question in classes that people say, well, you know, stoplights, yellow and red, but really came from the coral snake. So little trivia for you. And Bruce is exactly right. We often say those two ports are off limits, right? The only thing we use the distal port for is to transduce the PA waveform. And we would see in the ICU, we're not going to do this in transport again, they would draw an SVO2 from that port. We don't push medications. We don't push fluids. We don't do anything. You can push a small volume. We're talking just to flush the port if you draw an SVO2. But that does not mean you give volume from a volume challenge. You don't give blood. You don't give any vasopressors or anything like that. So, you know, not sure if the balloon port is inflated or not. When you come across a patient, that syringe we know is it looks like a 3C syringe, but it's a 1.5 cc syringe. It should be, I've seen two different protocols. I think the majority of protocols I've seen ICU-wise is that the balloon obviously is deflated, plunger is all the way down, it is on the port, and the actual port is clamped off. I have had a handful of nurses say that their ICU has a protocol where it's not clamped off. Yes, syringe is on, plunger is down, but it is not clamped off. So that's a variation in protocol that I've seen throughout the U.S. Bruce, what do you think?
Yeah, interesting. So I'll just go back and just remind people. So that syringe, like Eric said, that is a control syringe. That's what that syringe is called. It's controlled because you can only pull back. It's a 3cc syringe, but you can only pull back to 1.5 mLs. And that's because that's the total volume that can go into that balloon before it has the potential to rupture, right? And that is the last thing that we want, because we're just going to shower plastic emboli down and into the pulmonary arterioles. It's going to cause.
That doesn't sound good.
Yeah, no, not at all. So I guess, kind of for me, where this comes into play is I've heard paramedics and I've heard nurses say, you know, well, just hand me a 10cc syringe. I'll check that balloon. And I want to like grab their hand and like pull it away, because no, you really should be using the syringe that comes with that pulmonary artery catheter. It is there for a specific reason, right? But I totally agree with you. I think there's two different style practices out there, but both are really resultant in the fact that we're not going to really touch that balloon for fear of putting any air volume in it.
Yeah. So there's one question that popped up from Chris Jones that I want to highlight.
You beat me to it.
Yeah. And I think this is a question we touch on in the review courses.
Totally.
When we look at, you know, the European versus, you know, the Berlin different criteria of looking at ARDS, you know, I highly recommend to listen to that podcast, look at the article that we reference in there from PulmCrit that goes into pseudo ARDS. Really the question you're asking is in ruling out ARDS, you have two types of patients, right? You have acute versus chronic onset. Right? Chronic onset is going to be a CHFer. Acute onset is usually within a few hours, you know, 3 to 6, 8 hours. And then you look at indirect versus direct lung injury. But really, when you look at a chest x-ray, whether you have pulmonary edema or you have somebody in ARDS, you usually have bilateral involvement. We know ARDS is going to have oftentimes pulmonary infiltrates 50% of the time. And one of the differentials is to look at that pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. Well, if it's over 18, which we know a normal number is 8 to 12, that's an indication that they have a high left ventricular and diastolic pressure, i.e. a high afterload state, high SVR state, and they have a diastolic failure, which is causing a backflow into the mitral valve. Mitral valve has obviously failed, and we have a volume problem that's moving into the pulmonary veins, into the lungs, right? That's what's causing this phenomenon. And so that's where that pulmonary capillary wedge pressure that's high is used as a differential. You know, you would look at a chest x-ray and you would say, all right, well, what is this chest x-ray? Is it a AP view versus PA view? AP view, you know, based on the way that x-ray is done and how close the camera is to the heart, you're basically allowed a 60% variance between heart silhouette and chest wall width. And so you're going to look for cardiomegaly. You know, do you have a enlarged heart? Do you, what's the history? What's the medications involved? You know, is this acute versus chronic onset? All those things need to play into your differential. And wedge pressure is one of those things that I just don't, I think that's a last line thing. I think you can, in most cases, come up with an identification of what the diagnosis is before that. And again, could you use a PA diastolic in that situation? I definitely think that that's one of those criteria that if I had a patient right now, knowing all that, I would not wedge a catheter. I would not do it. I feel strongly that I could get that information and identify the overall shock state without that information.
Yeah, or like figure, get, use other information besides that. I mean, you even think about like a PA to FiO2 ratio.
Right.
Right. Absolutely. So that's like another perfect example of where you can use other information to kind of corroborate or validate that story. Yep. 100%. Yeah. All right. So that knocks out number four. And honestly, we touched on number five already, too.
We did. Yeah,
right?
We did.
Can we use the PA catheter distal port to infuse fluid? No way. Right. Not good practice at all. All right. So number six, we have ratios between non-invasive blood pressure and PA pressure. So what's up with this, Eric? Lead us down the road here.
Well, I think when we do our review courses and when we teach, whether that's online, we always try to, at least I feel super strong in that we want you to walk out of there and be able to take care of patients at a much higher level, right? Come out with these clinical nuggets that you can put in your tool bag. And I think one of the questions that we often hear in advanced hemodynamics and you hear in blue pump therapy is, What do I do with the pressures that I see? What are the differences? Like I have a automated blood pressure with our cardiac monitor and I have our, you know, PA systolic and diastolic pressures. Well, what do those variants mean? Yeah. And how do I apply that? And, you know, we could talk about this for a couple hours. I think that the clinical nugget that you need to take is that you want a 1-to-5 ratio. A 1-to-5 ratio is going to be very, very standard, meaning, you know, if I just throw a blood pressure out there, let's say you have a 125 over 75 blood pressure, right? And let's say your PA systolic diastolic is 25 over 10. We'll say 25 over 10. That's about a 1-to-5 ratio.
Yeah, sure thing.
So that's telling you that the pressures that are needing or that the heart is needing to generate that pressure are normal. For example, if we had a pressure of let's say you had neosinephrine on board, right? Neosinephrine is something that we talk about a lot in sepsis patients. But honestly, guys, it is used a lot in open heart surgery. It's used in the cath lab because it has phenomenal aortic root pressure and coronary perfusion pressure optimization. And so you will see most patients that come out of the OR into the cardiac ICU on neosinephrine, right? For that purpose. And so let's say you just were, you know, the dose is a little high and you were noticing that your patient had a pressure of all of a sudden it was like 200 over, you know, 105. And you looked at your PA pressures and your PA pressures were like 45 over 20, over 25. Well, they're both high. But if you do the math there, you're still at a 1-to-5 ratio. Mm-hmm. So that's telling you that your Frank Starling curve is proper, that you have an over-medication issue, right? So you could dial down the neosinephrine. In contrast, let's say for an example, you had a patient, I'm just throwing some stuff out there. Let's say you have a patient that you have a terrible blood pressure. You have a pressure of 75 over 50, or let's say 75 over 45. And you look at your PA pressures and your PA pressures are 55 over 40. Well, if you do the ratio there, your ratio is like terrible. I mean, you're like 1.3, 1.4, right? You're not even close to the 1.5. You're more like 1.2, 1.3. Well, in that case, you know, let's say if I added a scenario on there and I say, well, you intubated this patient and during intubation, they aspirated and during the, you know, because of the aspiration, now they're hypoxic. So the hypoxemia is causing, you know, the heart to not be able to do what it needs to do. So it's not generating enough pressure. And so, you know, the point is those ratios are very telling. you easily can be able to, you know, you can easily tell when you have a situation where you have a problem. You can easily say, hey, this is a hypoxic problem, or hey, you know, we have a major diastolic failure problem. Our SVR is skyrocketing. We definitely can look at that and say, man, we have to reduce our afterload state. We have to give a medication that's going to do that. So that ratio of 1 to 5 is our starting point. And then you have to be able to learn how you can optimize that. And we talk about this a lot in our courses.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we use a very simplistic way to think about, and it's called the triangle method. And I got to give the shout out to James Rutherford from out of Ohio, nurse practitioner. He taught me this in 2013. Bam. Yeah. And it is so simple. And hospital intensivist taught him this. And really, when you have a patient that's in front of you that's crashing and you are stumped, you and your partner are looking at each other. Let's say you're in a HEMS environment and you're like, where do we start? Simply get a piece of paper out and draw the triangle out. Say, all right, are we fluid overloaded? Do we have a high afterload state? Do we need to reduce SVR? Do we have a high left ventricular and diastolic pressure? You don't need a Swan-Ganz catheter to tell you that. You can look at history, right? You can look at history. You can look at the medications they're on. You can look at what's going on to tell you that that's what's going on. So maybe start dobutamine. Maybe go simple and go in nitro drip.
Yeah.
Maybe you need volume. Maybe you don't have enough volume, right? Is your heart rate appropriate? You know, I often give a scenario in the course where I give a heart rate that's very high. I give a heart rate of like 180. And I automatically say, I don't give you the monitor. I say you have a narrow complex rate of 180. And everybody in the class, every single class says this is SVT. But we got to remember that sinus tach is 220 minus your age. And that we need to go through the three H's. Are they hypoxic, hypovolemic, or hyperthermic? If you rule out those three things, then look at that and look at it from the SVT standpoint. But until those are proven not to be a problem, then you automatically have to say that that rate is due to one of those three things. So it's not as easy as we have a bradycardia or tachycardia. You have to identify, is that tachycardia as a result of those three things?
Yeah, sure thing.
And lastly, SVR. Again, that goes right back to the whole volume overload state. You know, some of that's going to be corrected. But a low SVR, think about the types of shock states, anaphylaxis, distributive shocks, neurogenic shocks. Why would you have a low SVR? Why would the patient not be compensated? I think that's probably the simplest thing. So this really hones you into, all right, I need to either add this medication, maybe I need to take this medication off. And not all medications are created equal, you know, and what's the best medication for each type of situation?
I'll tell you, this was something when I first learned it, it was like, why don't they teach this, right? Like, why don't they teach it like this kind of, after you've gone through all the nitty gritty, just like bring it full circle. This is like the perfect thing to do that, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Volume, heart rate, and SVR, right? If you can fix all three of them, or if you can fix 1, 2, 3, if you can go after those three endpoints, you would be, you'll be good. Your patient will be good.
Yeah, for sure. That also brings us to this little chart here, which I know we talk about all the time. It's not unique for us, but this is a good one to kind of remember, right? And, you know, Brucey, you want to talk about this one for a sec?
Of course I do. So there's a couple things that you'll see here. We have on the top of this graph different states, right heart failure, cardiogenic, obstructive, sepsis. And then you'll see below that four different parameters, and we get those parameters from monitoring advanced hemodynamics. So we can start out with a CVP, or central venous pressure, the pressure essentially that is synonymous with the pressure inside the right atrium, right? CVP, central venous pressure. The amount of blood coming back, or the amount of volume coming back to that right atrium, or to the right side of the heart. Below that, you'll see cardiac index. Remember that cardiac output equals stroke volume times heart rate. Once you obtain a liter flow per minute of cardiac output, you can divide your cardiac output over your body surface area, and that gives you your cardiac index, which can be, we'll say, more specific to that person's kind of hemodynamics in relation to their body habitus. We have SVR, systemic vascular resistance. Are your vessels clamped down, vasoconstricted, or are they vasodilated? And then pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. So I think it's helpful to, we're going to start back right at the top of the table, and let's talk about the normal values for those. And we can talk about whether they're high, low, that kind of thing. So very quickly, CVP, normal CVP, 2 to 6 millimeters of mercury, right? Cardiac index, normal cardiac output, 4 to 8. If you take your cardiac output and divide it in 2, right, you get 2 to 4. That's what your normal cardiac index is. That is a classic exam question, right? Somebody, they'll have a question there that says cardiac index of 3.1. And everybody says, oh my God, that's a low cardiac output. It is a low cardiac output, but they gave you the cardiac index, and that's a normal cardiac index.
Yeah.
Right. So 2 to 4. And then below that, we have our SVR. Remember, normal SVR, 800 to 1200 dynes per second. So 800 to 1200. So if you have an SVR of 400, low pressure, that patient is vasodilated. If you have a high SVR in the 1800s, patient has a super hyperdynamic system, that patient is vasoconstricted. And then we have the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, normal, like we've mentioned, 8 to 12. So I think, you know, one way to kind of approach this and how these numbers interact with each other, essentially, your central venous pressure should mimic, or your pulmonary capillary wedge pressure should really mimic your CVP. So if your CVP is high, your wedge pressure should be high. And that is true in almost every single case except one. Eric, which one is it?
You said your central venous pressure is high and your wedge pressure is high?
Yeah. No, if they're different. What's one scenario where they're
right
different?
Right heart failure.
Yeah, right-sided heart failure, right? If you have an inability of your right ventricle to push volume over to the left side, your wedge is going to be low, but that volume from the right ventricle is going to back up into the right atrium, and that's going to send your CVP through the roof. So you have a high CVP and a low wedge. That's the only time, just about the only time, that you'll see that variant. So in most cases, you're going to have, if your CVP is high, your wedge is high. So that's just an easy thing to remember, right? You can cue that very easily. CVP is high, my wedge should be high. If it's not, we got a problem, and we know right where that problem could be. So 26-year-old guy, status post-fall, head injury, intubated, right? Hypotensive, heart rate is in the 50s, so he's not tachycardic. Respiratory rate, you can see that. We can see some of the vent settings there. So let's go through this. CVP and wedge should mimic each other, right? So I see a CVP of 0. That's less than 2 to 6. That's low. I see a wedge of 2, less than 8. That's low. They're mimicking each other. Life is good so far. Pulmonary artery pressure is 14 over 3. Remember, 15 to 25 for systolic there. So you're just a little bit low on pulmonary artery pressure. Diastole, definitely low. And then I see a cardiac output of 7.9. Remember, 4 to 8, that's normal. And an SVR of 687, and bam, that brings it home right there. This patient is vasodilated out. So I have a patient who is vasodilated in a distributive style shock that has had some kind of head trauma or trauma. Boys, that's only singing one tune in my head, and what is it?
Neurogenic shock, baby.
Neurogenic shock. That is the classic picture for neurogenic shock right there. And you see no compensation with that heart rate because of the sympathetic blockade.
Yeah, and I think the big thing with this that really will differentiate this on an exam is going to be that cardiac output, mm-hmm. right? And the cardiac output is often taught as one of two things. Either it's going to be normal, And I think we got to remember, normal for a normal adult is right around 5 to 5.5 liters a minute, but our normal range is 4 to 8. And notice this is 7.9. So it is on the highest end of normal, but it's not generating anything, right? Because the container is so wide. So for me, that was always the key. What's the cardiac output doing, right? Because if you look at this from a sepsis standpoint, right, the hyperdynamic sepsis, patients are going to actually have an elevated cardiac output. They're going to be hyperdynamic in this case. And you know, initially their SVR is going to be high, right? And that's not what you see here. And so you, really for me, the cue is that cardiac output that's in that normal range. Even though it's on the high end of normal, it's normal.
On behalf of Eric Bauer and Bruce Hoffman, thank you guys so much for jumping on here and having a great discussion with us tonight. Probably one of our most popular live sessions out there. So that was really cool. So on behalf of Eric Bauer, Bruce Hoffman, this is Mike Verkest. You've been watching A Flight Bridgehead Live here on Facebook. We appreciate you hanging out with us for tonight. You guys all have a great night, and we will talk to you soon. All right, you guys take care. We'll see you.
This has been a production of the Flight Bridgehead Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.